This meeting is being recorded.
So will you be playing the video of this file anyway?
It's more of an audio thing. It's more of an audio thing.
Okay, fine. Yeah.
So my guest today is Ayush Puthran, who's written the book Unveiling Jazba, which is a history of Pakistan women's cricket after 25 years. It was published last year. And for me, it's an exciting book because the most fascinating aspect of Pakistan's cricket history, men or women, would be the development of women's cricket in Pakistan and the work the pioneers did in the 90s and early 2000s to get the game up and running and the national team up and running. So welcome, Ayush.
Hi, Abdullah. Nice to be here.
I know you touched on the work the pioneers did in great length in this particular book, but let's start off with yourself and just writing this book. Naturally, living in India and writing a book about Pakistan cricket is not the conventional thing to do. So were the eyebrows raised from, you know, family, friends and colleagues, particularly given that, you know, the current political climate between the two countries?
It's not like people in India are averse to Pakistan stories. If anything, they're more curious about knowing what's really happening there. So, because what we tend to get flooded with the mainstream media narratives and, you know, the fueling of hate and everything. So, of course, no one buys into it completely, but still, just because you've been told something over and over and over again, you sort of tend to believe there's some truth to it and all of that. But in general, there's curiosity, there is affection. And if you'll notice that every time there has been cricket matches played between India and Pakistan, whether it's in either of the countries or even outside when you go to UAE, you see there's so much of fueling of love that happens in a sense. You know, this, oh, we are brothers and all of that. That tends to happen. So not really. I mean, yes, they're sort of scared at times, you know, this shouldn't lead to any trouble. But they're just as curious as I was all these years to know what's really happening in Pakistan's cricket.
And what was the inspiration behind writing this book? Was there a particular match you saw? Was there a particular event? And also, just to add on to this question, how much did you know beforehand about Pakistan women's cricket? Did you have a rough idea of the history? Or was it something sort of brand new for you while researching?
So before I got into this, the only thing I knew was I was watching them play when they were playing against India. So against India, they were running them quite close between 2012 to 2018 at the World Cups. And they had even beaten India twice. So I was under the assumption maybe they're just as good as the Indian team. And I've been following the Indian team for quite some time. So I thought I was under that assumption that they were just as good. And I knew a few things. I knew a few players. I knew that Kiran Baloch held the world record and all of that. But nothing more than that. And as I clearly found out later that the assumption was wrong. And at my first, because I work as a cricket journalist, so I'm constantly talking to cricketers from around the world. This was the first time I was talking to Pakistanis, and there were like five of them from different parts of Pakistan. And they all had the same thing to say. And that sort of, not the same thing, but similar things about how their lives are. And they never saw themselves as a strong team, which sort of shook me at that point. Like, why do you think India, you're not as good as India? You've been beating India, you've been running them close. But it's only when I deep dived into their records and their matches and all of that, I figured out that there is a vast gulf. But what prompted me to write this book was purely the stories, because having writing for past 10 years, more than that, for last 10 years I've been writing, and there is no other story, cricketing story, mainstream cricketing story, so to say, that is so wild and different. And because you hear all sorts of stories, okay? I mean, especially when we are doing IPL, you see people coming from all parts of the country. And India is a vast country. Anyway, you see, even in women's cricket, there are a lot of stories. Yet, this sort of just stood out in so many ways. And that is what sort of prompted me to write. I mean, there were other factors into it that I had a sort of a leg accident and I was sitting at home, I had nothing to do. And that was followed up by the pandemic lockdown again, nothing to do, no cricket happening. So there was a lot of time I had with myself to sort of deep dive into something totally different.
And how long did it take for you to put this book together?
3 years.
3 years. And I want to touch on the cover photo that you've got here of Sana Mir. Was it a straightforward decision? Because she's obviously the most popular Pakistan women's player, although she's been retired for almost 3 years now. But was there a thought of perhaps having a team photo or having a photo of the Khan sisters or of the current captain, Bisma Maru?
Yeah, there were a lot of options. In fact, there was one option with Anam Amin as well that I offered. But everything was shot down because it's not my own call. This is a call of the publishers. So in the publisher in the UK, he was like, he wanted this because everybody else felt that Sanami's photo worked best for the book. Personally, not me, but both the publishers in India and UK. And it's come for some good feedback that people have loved that cover photo, but I can't take credit for that because clearly I didn't want it. Of course, I would have liked Shaiza's photo, Shaiza and Sharmeen, but we didn't have a photo of good enough quality to just in terms of pixels and all of that for the cover. And there were some team photos in consideration. There were a lot of other photos in consideration, but this is the one that went ahead eventually. Not my call, though.
So last year was the 25th anniversary of Pakistan as an international women's team. And naturally, when you're publishing a book, you want the team also to do well. Naturally, the sales will improve and things like that. But they didn't have a particularly good year, did they, last year, which must have disappointed you as an author in terms of the World Cup. They slipped up against Bangladesh, and then the Commonwealth Games, they slipped up against Barbados, and in the Asia Cup, they slipped up against Malaysia. So there are three games there they should have been winning when it comes to tournament cricket last year. And also at the end of the year, they slipped up against Ireland at home in a 2020 series. So it was one of their, not a particularly memorable year for Pakistan cricket, was it, at the time that you were sort of publishing and promoting this book?
I didn't get the last bit of your question.
It wasn't a particularly memorable year for Pakistan cricket, was it, the 25th anniversary, at the time that you were trying to promote and publish this book with the results that transpired?
No, I mean, Pakistan in general has not been a team that wins. It's a team that tends to lose more often than win. And the victories have also come against sort of lesser known sides, because you see the Asian Games victories. I mean, gold medal, fantastic achievement. But when you go down and see which teams did they played China, Japan, Thailand, and Bangladesh. And Bangladesh back then wasn't as strong. So you'd probably see that, yes, maybe it's not a great cricketing achievement, but they're building on. Every year, there has been one or the other victory that has come along, which is a big win. Like here, I think last year, they still beat India. That's a big win, and that sort of turns things around slightly for them. And that's been happening every year. There's been one victory or the other. In 2011, I think they beat South Africa. 2012, they beat India. 2013. No, 2012, I think they beat England as well. So, I mean, it's phenomenal that you could beat England with that team and with the kind of challenges that you're up against. Yes, England were experimenting in that match. But there has been a year, 2017, when they beat New Zealand. I mean, these are not victories that come easy. But that has come. So, one victory at a time, more or less. They did fabulously well in 2019 against South Africa. They traveled to South Africa, did exceptionally well across the entire series for a long period of time in both the formats. So that is probably, so you'd see that these performances have been one-off, more or less. So, but that is the story of Pakistan. It is not, I mean, even to understand how do they manage to win, because if you kind of see the challenges, you'd be surprised that how are they even there in the top eight, because they're up against mammoth issues and hurdles along the way to be there. The fact that they are there, they're competing and even managing to beat even England once, okay, that's a huge deal. Or New Zealand and all these countries, even India. I mean, now India and Pakistan are nowhere close to being at par. But the fact that they could beat a team like India is a great achievement. So yes, there you'll find these odd defeats every now and there where, you know, they've lost to Barbados. It almost seems like they're always in this phase of trying to find the perfect 11. And it's not really worked out as yet. But if you see individually, there are certain players who have come out and have done well. Sidra Amin this year. I mean, Fatima Sana is there. You know, Aisha Naseem is going to come through in a couple of years. Some phenomenal talents. I mean, Tuba Hasan came through this year. So there are certain positives on an individual level, but collectively, yes, the team continues to sort of be where they are, more or less. Because we also have to realize that the other teams are also improving. Bangladesh has improved so much, significantly. But there's also a reason, because the set of senior players have all sort of reached the prime and they've all come up together. The same players who were playing 10 years back weren't performing as well. But now that they're all there together, they're doing well. With Pakistan, the senior players have sort of been phased out. Bisma and Javeria are just the two of them that are remaining right now. And Anida Dar, of course, yeah.
So you touched on the three victories Pakistan have had over India. And one of them was after your book was published, which was at the Asia Cup last year. Which of those three victories is the most significant in your opinion? Or the most impressive of the three victories?
Well, that's a good question. It has to be the first one. Certainly not this one. I don't know, conflicted between the first and the second one, 2012 World T20 and 2016. I'm not entirely sure which one is bigger. Because to beat India in the World Cup, remember till 2016, no men's team had ever beaten India at a World Cup. And I think around the 2016 time, there was a statement by Shahid Afridi just a year back or something that, you know, hamare khawateen ki haate, whatever, it's soft and it's meant to be, they make good food and all of that. And Shahid Afridi sort of led aside and they also lost that day. I think this was 2012, I'm not sure which year. But Pakistan women's team, that the next day, I think they turned up and won against India. So, I mean, the first time is just to make them believe, yes, you're good enough to beat India. And that is immensely significant because that changes the outlook of all the players involved, that they're good enough to be there and be competing against teams like India. So I would say certainly not the third one, but the first and the second one, I would say.
I remember the first one wasn't quite televised at that stage. They were just showing semi-finals and finals rather than the whole tournament. So let's move on to who, in your opinion, has been Pakistan's greatest ever women's captain based on your research of the book?
Captain?
Yes.
Captain Sana Mir. Oh, okay. This is Shaiza Khan. See, remember, Shaiza Khan and Sana Mir both have played different roles. What Shaiza did in 1990, Sana couldn't have done. You needed a Shaiza Khan to get things going at that point of time. Nobody else could have. You needed a character like Shaiza. So Sana couldn't have done what Shaiza did. Shaiza couldn't have done what Sana did. Because Shaiza clearly couldn't have worked under PCB. Because, you know, Sana is sort of, she likes to take control. Shaiza likes to take complete control. So if you're going as a captain, a net is reserved for your team and that's taken away time and again, Sana will go up to the administrators and question them. Shaiza will just build another set of facilities and take the entire team to train there. So that is the sort of difference between Shaiza and Sana. So I think Shaiza, I mean, to start an entire cricket team is a crazy, crazy achievement. And it's not like you're being supported by the system around you. You're not being supported. The system is coming against you. And you've built an entire system. That is an achievement. No player in Pakistan, not a Kardar, not an Imran, nobody can claim to have done what Shaiza did. So I think maybe now, I think I'll have to change that to Shaiza. But Sana also had a very significant role to play later on, which is because at that point, you know, when girls are sort of scared, they sort of need a figure they're not scared of, they can trust and they can be themselves in. Sana was a bit of a nurturing figure for the players around in that setup because a lot of people are scared of Shaiza. I mean, I think in Jodie Davis now, 25 years since she coached Pakistan, I think she's still scared of Shaiza slightly. So you sort of needed a figure they could sort of be a little more tender. And I think Sana was that figure. But I would still say Shaiza was the most significant, not just a captain, the most significant figure in Pakistan women's cricket.
So let's touch on the Karachi Test match in 2004. And I noticed you dedicated a whole chapter of your book to this particular Test match, where Kiran Bellot scored 242 and Shaiza Khan took 13 wickets, including a hat-trick. And that to this date was the last Test match Pakistan ever played, and will perhaps ever play going forward as well. So I want to know that in 2005, the merger happened and cricket came under the PCB. Now, why did these players such as Shaiza and Kieran call it quits? And it seems a great shame because they were really coming into their own as players and they still had so much more to give, particularly Kieran, who I believe was still in her 20s when she made that double 100.
Can you repeat the question, please?
Sure. So I'm talking about when the merger happened in 2005, why did the likes of Kieran and Shaiza decide not to continue? And it seems a great shame because they had so much more to give, particularly Kieran, who scored a double 100 in 2004 and barely played after that. And also Shaiza, I mean, she took 13 wickets and again, she still had at least a couple of years left in her.
So, firstly, they were always fighting PCB. They were fighting PCB for around 5 years by that point, Shaiza and Kieran. And when the merger, there was no way but the merger had to happen since it had happened from at the ICC level itself. Shaiza and PCB struggled to come to terms, and PCB was being sort of handled by Meera Fehlbuz. Meera Fehlbuz was still sort of an outsider to the system. There was Shamsha Hashmi, with whom they were already sort of, there were frictions. Shahryar Khan, who was the PCB chair at that point, there were frictions between Shaiza and Shahryar Khan, and Shaiza and Shamsha Hashmi. So Shaiza had certain demands of what she expected. And clearly, Shamsha Hashmi didn't want to give her that sort of respect or that sort of authority which she had previously, because they also wanted to sort of take control of the women's game. So in this entire issue, I think there came up a domestic competition where the claim was whoever wins this domestic competition, the captain of that side will go on to lead Pakistan, which was sort of a bizarre arrangement. But Karachi was still confident. Shaiza was still confident that Karachi will beat all these teams. And there was a match just before the final between Karachi and Lahore, in which, and just before the match, a few of the Karachi players were seen mingling with the Lahore players. And Shaiza was not happy with that because there was a lot of distrust that Shaiza had towards the Lahore team. And seeing that, you know, Karachi players are mingling with the Lahore players, Shaiza was not at all happy. So there was already some fight before the match. Shaiza was not happy with some of the players. And when the match happened, Shaiza and Kiran sort of believed that some of the players in that team, Uruj Mumtaz and Sanamir and all of them, are underperforming. Which if you actually go to see, they really didn't. But they still feel that while they were fielding, there were some lapses on the field, and she didn't expect that from Uruj Mumtaz, who was a fantastic fielder, and Sanamir, who was one of those bright young talents. So when that happened, although Karachi won, but when the match was going on, Shaiza was livid. She was sort of aggressive, abusing the players and all of that in the moment of anger. And Shamsha Hashmi, who was playing for Lahore at that point, noticed all of this. And she came up to these players and said, I think you need to file a complaint against Shaiza because this doesn't work out. No one can talk to you like that. No one can be abusing you like that. And because they were young and sort of misled or whatever, they did go and file a complaint. And when they did go to the PCB office to file a complaint, they went under the pretext. They told Shaiza that they're going to meet some of their relatives or something of that sort. Shaiza, of course, found out that they didn't go to meet their relatives. They were there at the PCB office talking to Meera Fehlbuz and Shamsha Hashmi, with whom Shaiza anyway sort of didn't trust them. So Shaiza has this belief, although it is not proven, that there were some shady dealings that sort of took place. Although there's no proof as yet presented to me, but they claim they have the proof with them. But Sanamir, on the other hand, believes that all of this was misunderstood. Similar with Batul Fatima, she believes that this entire situation was misunderstood by Shaiza. Because Shaiza, after the match got over, she even apologized to the players for having abused them. So it's like, if you have apologized, now what are you going and complaining for? So this entire turn of events took place and what happened in the final. Lahore won, and the Lahore captain didn't go on to become the Pakistan captain, even though she was the captain before the tournament. It was Uruj Mumtaz who became the captain. So this sort of strengthened Shaiza's theory that there was something shady that took place between the PCB officials and Uruj Mumtaz and Sana Mir. Because remember, Uruj Mumtaz became the captain 3 years later. Sana Mir became the captain. And of course, by then Shaiza was cut off and she didn't know that even Uruj and Sana didn't sort of get along in the best of terms. So, but she believed that because this was the deal that was offered to Uruj and Sana, that is why they went on to become the captains. It's a completely messed up situation. But in this messed up situation, Shaiza and Kiran didn't want to do anything with cricket any further. So they left midway through that competition and never joined Pakistan cricket back.
Now, I know you've managed to track down the pioneers of Pakistan women's cricket, who are not easy to get hold of, and they live very private lives these days. People like Shaiza Khan, as you mentioned, and Kiran Baloch. I want to know, how much do they follow the progress of the current team? And is there any sort of enthusiasm for them, from their point of view, to get involved in Pakistan cricket again? I know you touched on in your book that Ihsan Mani, when he was the PCB chairman, he invited Shaiza Khan to take over the women's wing. But yeah, Shaiza refused at the time, although it seems from my impression that her sister's death at the time could have been one of the factors. But is there any sort of enthusiasm or scope for them to get back involved in Pakistan cricket, or are they content with the lives they are living now away from the public eye? And again, how much do they follow the progress of the current team?
So clearly they don't want to get involved, because Shaiza, as I said earlier, she cannot be a puppet. If she takes control, if she's offered to run women's cricket, she wants to give the team the best of facilities, best of everything. That is what she did as the captain as well. Limited resources, she put in all the money, she made things happen. And you see the system right now, you see how things are running in Pakistan women's cricket. They're not well paid. I mean, the kind of issues that they keep coming up with as women cricketers, I don't think that will be acceptable for Shaiza. She'll end up getting into more fights than actually solutions there. So clearly, I don't think Shaiza will get back and work under PCB, work under somebody's commands and restrictions. If at all she would want to take control, she would want to take complete control of everything. That is the only way she functions. I don't know, because I don't think she follows it completely, the cricket right now, but she will be watching the World Cup. I've had a conversation with her a few days back, and she said she'll be watching the upcoming World Cup. So I don't know to what extent does she follow, because she really doesn't talk about the cricket team as much. I mean, just to talk about Shaiza, you know, Shaiza, after Shaiza left, there was no test cricket for Pakistan. So all the tests that happened for Pakistan was because of Shaiza. But it's not just Pakistan. All the test cricket that happened for Ireland was also because of Shaiza Khan. Had it not been Shaiza Khan, Ireland would have never played test cricket. And to a great deal, I also believe it is true for Sri Lanka as well. Had it not been for Shaiza, maybe to a great extent, Sri Lanka also would have probably never played test cricket. So Shaiza's influence is not just limited to Pakistan cricket. It's at a global scale, what she has managed to achieve, because she's been so pushy with wanting to get things done. And of course, with cricket, it's not like just because one team wants to play a match can happen. The other team also has to agree. And when Ireland was not agreeing, she pushed her luck to a great deal of, because Ireland didn't have money to get a match going, but she sort of convinced them.
And I'm sure you're following Pakistan's current tour of Australia, which is a high profile tour because they're playing on free to air in Australia. And obviously they're the only touring team there this summer in Australia, as far as women's cricket is concerned. For me, they've been more competitive than I thought. I'm sure you're following their progress with interest, having written this book. And do you feel they'll be battle hardened from this tour of Australia going into that 2020 World Cup, where they take on India in just 2 weeks' time?
I hope so, because you never know. They're of course going to Australia knowing that even one victory or even coming close to Australia is sort of an achievement. But when you're getting beaten the way they're getting beaten, I mean, yes, they're putting up a fight to some extent, but it can get deflating, I would believe, as a team. I mean, I've not played cricket at that level, but knowing these cricketers, because previously, even previously, when these matches would happen against Australia, yes, they sort of agreed that they would be happy that they gave their best. But I don't know, would it be too deflating after a point? Because, I mean, every coach says this, players would say this as well, that winning is a habit, so is losing. So when you sort of lose match after match after match, when there comes a match where you can possibly win, you're so used to losing, you don't know how to sort of turn things around. When a team is winning, they sort of know, even from a tricky situation, how to sort of get a victory out. And that is sort of common in sports. And I hope that is not the case with Pakistan going into the World Cup now, given the number of losses they've had and the kind of just dominance that Australia have had. But Australia, you're expected to sort of dominate. So I don't know what frame of mind the players are in and what frame of mind they will be going into the World Cup.
So in 2013, there was a Women's World Cup in India. And I'm sure you touched on in the book that the Pakistan players were housed in the stadium at the time. And I find that a bit interesting because just the previous month or so before that, the Pakistan men's team actually toured India for an ODI and a T20 series. So I'm just wondering what went wrong.
2012.
What, yes. So what exactly went wrong in that 1 month period that
Pakistan? There was a ceasefire violation at the border, and a lot of issues happened at that, and that became sort of that got picked up, and that became a big news. And of course, there are political parties of all kinds in India, and yeah, when there is a violation and the army is impacted and all of that, it becomes sort of grave. Because even when they were trying to sort of mend fences, that was the first time they sort of invited the Pakistani team over. They're trying to sort of create this peaceful atmosphere. But soon after that, and things went off, especially in Kashmir at that point. So I think maybe that played a huge role in changing the mood of, you know, whether to, I don't know what sort of relations they wanted to have. And again, these are certain fringe political parties that create this sort of atmosphere. It's not the main Congress, so to say, at that point. Congress was the government, or UPA, as you call it, the government. It was not the government. It was those who were not in power who were really protesting against this. So, yeah, that was an issue.
And how much do you think that hindered their performance in that particular tournament where they were winless?
Sorry?
How much do you feel that was a factor which hindered their performance for why they were winless in the tournament? In terms of being housed in the stadium, I mean, it's not a particularly pleasant experience for a cricket team, particularly for the youngsters to go through. Do you feel that was a major hindrance for their performance, or lack of performance in that particular campaign?
That is what the team says. I mean, the coach and the captain say, Sanamir and Mohtasham Rashid, that it did have an impact because coming into the World Cup, they were in good form. They had a very good 2012. So they were in good form. It did impact Pakistan to a great extent. But I don't know if that could have changed their fortunes in the sense, as in they could have qualified to the next round or something if had this not happened. I don't know. Because Pakistan have sort of underperformed in world events historically. So I don't know whether that would have helped them win a match or not. But the team, it's not just, in fact, the captain, the other players also admit that it did impact them because they were not used to playing in such restricted environments and they were not in the best of mind space at that point. But whatever it is, I mean, I've written it, what they've said, the kind of experiences they've had through the course of the World Cup. But that is not to say that they would have otherwise started winning. I'm not sure of that entirely. But maybe they could have put up better performances. Probably. I mean, all assumption right now, yeah.
So let's move on to Uruj Mumtaz and Sanamir. I was interested that in 2009, there was a Women's World Cup in Australia where Pakistan actually won a couple of games against Sri Lanka and West Indies. And Uruj was a young captain at that stage. She was in her early 20s, but she didn't captain for much more after that tournament. So what exactly went wrong in... Why was she sort of removed from captaincy after a promising show in that World Cup in Australia in 2009, but Pakistan actually won a couple of games.
Because just heading into the World Cup, there was, 2008, if I'm not wrong, there was a government change. So when there was a government change, the PCB changes. And when PCB changes, the women's wing head changes. So Shamsha Hashmi and Meera Felbus went out. Shireen Javed and Bushra Ehtezaz came in. And Bushra Ehtezaz and the two groups of Shamsha Hashmi and Shireen Javed, they have been at war for more than a decade by then. So if Shamsha Hashmi trusted Uruj Mumtaz, Bushra Ehtezaz and Shireen Javed's group clearly didn't want a captain who had the trust of their rival group. So they wanted a change in captaincy, but Sana Mir claims that she refused to become the captain just before the World Cup because they were leading up to the World Cup, she wanted some stability. So once the World Cup got over, Uruj was removed and Sana came into the picture. So it has got to do with sort of a rivalry at a higher position between those heading the women's wing. And then, that's a problem with Pakistan cricket, you know. I mean, it starts from the very top. Governments don't survive. They do not complete full tenures. I think in the history of Pakistan in 75 years since its independence, there have been just two democratically elected governments that have completed their full tenure. And when the government is not completing the tenure, the PCB chair don't complete the tenure. I mean, now Ramiz Raja is out. I mean, another new Najam Sethi is back in. No one knows for how long will he survive, will he even complete his full tenure. And when they are not completing the full tenure, the women's wing, of course, gets affected. It's a whole lot of mess. It's a whole lot of chaos. And unless there is some sort of stability, it will start impacting the cricket. There's no other way out. I mean, that's unfortunate. And that's been the case of Pakistan forever now. I mean, yeah.
And was that also a factor for why Uruj sort of quit in 2009/2010? Because she was, again, in her early 20s at that stage, or mid-20s. And, she didn't play after that. Was that her removal a factor for her going completely in terms of leaving international cricket?
So, Uruj didn't agree to speak for the book. I mean, I did speak to her
over
emails and phone calls and messages and everything. But she never eventually ended up talking to me for the book. So I don't have Uruj's version as to why she didn't come back. Sanami's version was that she just wrote a letter, an email was sent, and yeah, she never turned up after that, saying that I won't be able to join. And she sort of pursued, what is just told to us is that she pursued her dentistry and she didn't want to get back to cricket. But what the real reason is, only Uruj will be able to explain. And that's on Uruj, because I don't have a complete explanation from her in as yet.
Okay, we'll just build on this in part two, as this recording link is about to come to an end.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
This meeting is being recorded.
So we were touching on the Uruj versus Sana scenario just previously there. It's interesting because now that sort of rivalry between the two has extended to broadcasting, where Uruj has sort of overtaken Sana. So it's still sort of playing out now in their post-retirement careers.
It's a different field. And, you know, I mean, I'm personally of this belief and I've spoken to a few people as well. I believe that Uruj and Sana both are the best two best commentators Pakistan have right now. I don't know how the Pakistanis see it, but having spoken to all the Indians, Uruj is just a natural on the mic. Sana brings in a lot of depth and analysis into the game. And I don't think Pakistan has better commentators. And I'm saying a lot of things, but yeah, I don't think Pakistan have better commentators right now. But Uruj is clearly a natural on the mic and a fine, fine commentator. But it's a different field altogether. It's not meant necessarily for just ex-cricketers. It can be, specialized commentators are there. From India, there is Harsha Bhogle. Very few of them, but, you know, natural storytellers who are good on the mic. So not all cricketers become good speakers.
Yes, it's an interesting dynamic because Sana was clearly the more recent player and the higher profile player. And when she retired, I know that the commentary was a big goal for her. But Uruj seems to have overtaken her in terms of when she got a chance. And now she's becoming the more regular commentator for Pakistan home series. And Sana's sort of getting the lesser profile series when they can't get hold of the bigger names. So it's interesting that this dynamic is still playing out in their post-playing careers.
So Sana Mir is doing commentary for the World Cup. I mean, the previous World Cup, Sana Mir was there.
Correct.
Uruj Mumtaz is yet to do commentary for the World Cup, but I think she'll be a good fit.
It's just the only caveat there is that at the time, Pakistan were playing Australia in a test series in Pakistan, and Uruj was calling that, and that was sort of a big deal because Australia were there after 24 years. And although I know that ICC seems to favour Sana, but PCB, at least, I think, now they see Uruj as the number one female commentator, even though perhaps initially they had Sana in mind, but once Uruj has got a chance, she sort of run away with it.
Yeah.
So let's move on to another topic. So absence of India versus Pakistan cricket, I'm just wondering how much does that impact Pakistan in particular? Naturally, they're missing out on playing one of the stronger teams in women's cricket by India not playing them in bilateral contests. And also, culturally, India is a team that Pakistan can relate to more.
What was your question? Can you be a little louder?
Sure. So my question was absence... Sorry, can you hear me now?
Hello.
Hello, can you hear me?
Please.
Can you hear me now? Have you got me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, now I can.
Yeah, can you just repeat the question? Yeah.
So my question was about the absence of India versus Pakistan bilateral cricket and how that's impacting Pakistan's growth as a team, because naturally they're missing out on playing one of the stronger teams in the international circuit in women's cricket. And also, culturally, I feel India as a team, Pakistan can relate to more compared to an Australia or an England or a South Africa or a New Zealand in terms of players coming from humble beginnings, perhaps not quite to the same extent as Pakistan, but to humble beginnings nonetheless. And also raising the profile of cricket in Pakistan, absence of India versus Pakistan cricket, it's not helping that in terms of raising the profile of women's cricket in Pakistan. So just a word on that and how that's perhaps hindering Pakistan's development somewhat.
Yeah, I mean, in 25 years, India and Pakistan have never played together, a bilateral series. The only time they do play is during the World Cups or during the Asia Cups. That's it. So there has never been a bilateral series, irrespective of who's been in the government, what the relations have been. Even in the best of times between India and Pakistan, when the men were sort of having bilateral tours, there was no bilateral series between India and Pakistan women's team. And that clearly, because that is what will generate interest among fans to go and watch the women's team play. And nothing, not even a World Cup, can generate the kind of interest that an India-Pakistan bilateral series can generate. Because that will happen over, say, three T20Is and three ODIs. That's a long duration. So clearly, it will have an impact. And more than that, even now, you see the women's IPL is coming up, women's Premier League as its term. The kind of money that's coming in, you need that. Because honestly, Pakistan cricketers are not being paid well enough. And there is only, except for Nida Dar, nobody made it to an international league so far. Yes, there is Fair Break Global, but that's, I don't know, it's not like a proper cricket tournament. So you need that sort of an exposure with India as well. I mean, it would just help both the teams, both the countries, especially Pakistan. I mean, there's no denying that, but it's just not happening. I mean, that last time at least Pakistan could have got points because India backed out. that also didn't happen because there was a pandemic and there was an abrupt end to the cricketing cycle. Pakistan would have qualified directly to the final of the tournament, but that unfortunately didn't happen.
And when ties do resume, whenever they do resume, do you feel there's a scope for a potential test match between the two, or do you think that's a thing of the past and Pakistan isn't going to play any test cricket going forward as far as the women's team is concerned?
I'm not sure. I mean, Pakistan, except for India, South Africa, Australia and England, no one else has played test cricket ever since ICC took over. Not even New Zealand, no West Indies, no Sri Lanka. So that seems highly unlikely, but I wouldn't rule that out. But test cricket is not something that is high on the priority list of any of the boards for women's cricket. With Australia and England, at least it comes packaged in a different format, like an Ashes or something. And there is a bit of token test cricket that happens for India as well. But other than that, it's not on a high priority list for the boards or even the ICC. So whether or not that happens, I don't know whether crowds will come in to watch India and Pakistan women cricketers play test cricket. They may come in for T20Is, they may come in for ODIs. So, I mean, that was, I think, one of the decisions when the ICC committee had sat, I think, in 2018. They were like, if fans are not coming, if sponsors are not coming, who are they playing for? So that was sort of a question that was raised. So I'm not sure where the test match would resume. But
I'm of the view that if Pakistan ever do play another women's test, the best chance of it happening would be against, say, in India, if ties do resume down the line.
Sorry?
I was of the view that if they ever do resume playing women's test cricket, it would be against India from Pakistan's point of view, if ties do resume down the line.
That's true.
Coming back to the 2004 Karachi Test match, it came to my attention that there was an India tour of Pakistan on at the time. And perhaps that's one of the reasons that that particular series or that particular tour from the West Indies didn't generate much interest. And it was also interesting that a few weeks later, Brian Lara also scored the highest score in men's test cricket. And that's also stood until this day. So that's a couple of interesting observations I made about that particular tour, the 2004 West Indies tour to Pakistan, which was quite significant, wasn't it? It was the first time a proper team had gone over to Pakistan.
Yeah. I mean, that's the only time a test match has been hosted in Pakistan. And West Indies were not even, they hadn't even planned of coming to Pakistan. They were playing a series in India. And Chaiza is like, okay, you all are there. Can you all come here? And just, I mean, from the fact that world records in test cricket and women's test cricket both are held by two Pakistanis, I mean, that is where you're getting global recognition for in your women's cricket. So that, I mean, it would have nearly not happened. That's a fantastic part of that. Because Ramiz Raja sort of wrote a letter to the West Indies cricket board asking them not to send their players here to play. How did they even get that venue? Because that venue is sort of controlled by the PCB. So how did Chaiza convince the PCB to give them that venue at a time when PCB didn't even want them to play? It's intriguing how the whole politics of Pakistan works out. But they got the national stadium to play in. They registered world records and they still stand. And even now, when you go back and check the records, Pakistanis are at the top. And that is very rare in the women's cricket in anywhere. I mean, not even women's cricket, even in men's cricket. How many records are really held by Pakistanis? Yes, there's a Wasim Akram somewhere. But other than that, it's Kiran Baloch and Shahiza Khan. So clearly, that test match is immensely significant and that will be remembered for a really long time. I mean, somebody has to break a lot of records to make that unworthy.
And that particular tour was the last we saw of Shahiza Khan and Kiran Baloch appearing for Pakistan, even though at the time, perhaps that's not what they had in mind, but it turned out to be the last time they played for Pakistan. Building on that, there's a photo in the book of the Khan sisters with Kiran Baloch and John Major, the Prime Minister of England. I'm just wondering, when was that photo taken? That interests me. Do you have any idea?
I think it would be around 2000. I think 2000 was the year when they traveled to Ireland and they went to England. They played against the MCC. And there are a lot of cricket they played, not international cricket, but a lot of club cricket they played through that entire year. Shaiza organized a lot of matches, and so I'm assuming it should be around that time because they were there for a really long period in England. And they played against the MCC side as well.
And building on this conversation about Shaiza and Kiran and the early pioneers, I'm just wondering how much of a factor was Pakistan's men's team winning the 1992 World Cup sort of a motivation or an incentive for them to start the women's team? I know Benazir coming into power was a factor. I know they attended the 1993 Women's World Cup final at Lord's, and that was an inspiration for them. But did the 1992 men's triumph in Australia have any sort of impact for them in terms of inspiring them and encouraging them to start a women's team? Or was it just those two factors?
It's actually an interesting question, although Shaiza or Kiran have never spoken about 92 World Cup having an impact, because they did try to start a cricket team in 1988 as well. But in 93, during when the World Cup was being played in England, when they saw these things happening and they couldn't be a part of it, that was sort of an instigator for them. So you don't know what was a soft influence of the 92 World Cup for them specifically, but it was for an entire generation of women cricketers who came thereafter. That 92 was when they got hooked on to the sport, and they sort of took a liking to the sport, and they started playing at homes and started watching those games and sort of aspired to be a part of. I mean, aspirations came much later, because back then they didn't even know of an existence of a cricket team. So whenever that team, they found out about it, they wanted to play. And for a lot of them, that early motivation was that 92 World Cup for an entire generation thereafter. But Shaiza and Kiran specifically haven't mentioned about that World Cup having an impact on their aspirations as such.
And in the 1997 World Cup that Pakistan participated in, they lost all five matches, but was their high point the match against England, where they managed to bat out their 50 overs? And I believe an England player mentioned on the bus journey in the morning to the bus driver that we won't be long, come by lunchtime or something along those lines. That was the high point of their campaign, wasn't it, in 1997, where they managed to bat out the 50 overs against England and show some resistance?
Exactly, because just the match before that, Denmark had sort of rolled them over. And if Denmark can roll you over, England, who were like the favourites, who I think went on to, did Australia or England? I'm not sure. England were the defending champions, yeah. So you're expecting that England would like wipe them out, and they're coming anyway into the match with lack of sleep. Back then, fitness standards were not strong enough for them to survive on the field for 100 overs. And to be able to play out 100 overs, they sort of overheard a conversation, one of the players, that England said that, yeah, okay, we'll call the bus driver by lunch break. We should get done with it soon. Because that's what happened later against Australia, where Australia sort of rolled them over pretty quickly and got done with it by lunch break, and the match was over. But that they could do that because they didn't have the technique to last 50 overs. They didn't have the strength to bat for as long as they did after being on the field for 50 overs and just running around gathering balls. It was a phenomenal achievement, because they've not played cricket of that standard ever. They've not encountered that. Most of the players are still playing just their second or third game or whatever that was of a cricket match. Crazy achievement. It's tough to put it into perspective what they did with that. I mean, just to keep England bowlers at bay for 50 overs when you're running short of sleep, when you're tired, when you just don't have enough cricketing technique, so to say, to survive that long.
And I'm wondering, have you interviewed players from other countries about their views on Pakistan cricket, particularly that 1997 campaign? For example, I noticed players like Clare Connor played in that fixture. And I noticed in 1997, when Pakistan toured Australia and New Zealand, Mel Jones also made her debut. So have you interviewed these sorts of figures about their impressions of Pakistan cricket at the time? Because there's not much coverage, is there? Particularly in the 90s.
Yeah.
You need to get these insights from others.
So, yeah. So thankfully, because I knew a lot of these Indian players, so I mean, I got in touch with the Indian players who were a part, but although they didn't play against Pakistan, they had some exchanges. One of them played against Pakistan in a match, in a practice game before the World Cup actually began. So they shared their experiences. Of course, there was Jody Davis, who had played against Pakistan before she coached them. So, when they had come to Australia, she had played against them in a local match again at Canberra. And a lot of these cricketers, I sort of spoke to them after writing the book. That is when they came forward, because it was tough to track them. A lot of them who did play don't recall enough of Pakistan, which has been, I don't know, very bizarre case. It's not just about 97, even as late as 2013 World Cup. A lot of players who played against Pakistan don't recall much about them. They've just come, they're like, okay, we are going to roll them over. They come, they beat them, and they just go out. They don't remember much of Pakistan's cricket. I mean, all they remember is they were not a strong enough side. So that was sort of sad in a way, because you want your oppositions to sort of remember you, something that you did, because you recall that one good moment that you performed there with the bat or with the ball. But oppositions, a lot of them don't recall enough. But I can give them that benefit of doubt. 25 years is a long time. Jody Davis remembers every little detail. She has documented every little detail, extensive notes and photos and notes behind photos. She has everything written down. So, but other than that, it was a little difficult. But I did speak to some of the Indians, recall quite a bit of, not just the players, even the journalists, about the Pakistani team.
And I'm just wondering, I know you touched briefly on the book about Bangladesh cricket and Bangladesh women's cricket as well. Culturally, I imagine they'd be quite similar to Pakistan, but their story doesn't seem to be as interesting, does it? Or as fascinating or as controversial.
Bangladesh cricket? The history of Bangladesh cricket?
In comparison to Pakistan cricket, I imagine it would be similar in terms of being an Islamic country and, you know, being a patriarchal society.
But no, Bangladesh is slightly different. Bangladesh is, the entire world is a patriarchal society. But Bangladesh on that regard is slightly better. In fact, way better. I mean, I've done a piece with a friend of mine, but because I don't understand Bengali, I left it to him. But when he translated that into English, there's a significant difference between how Bangladeshi cricket has evolved. Yes, the structural issues might be there, but just in terms of permissions and everything, they're much better than Pakistan, from my limited knowledge of Bangladesh cricket.
That's interesting, because I imagine they would be quite similar, being an Islamic country as well. So that's interesting.
And they're economically also better off. I mean, just the per person GDP, what's that term? I forgot the term, where GDP divided by the average number of people, it's better in Bangladesh as compared to Pakistan. So economically, they're better. Socially, it's much slightly easier than it's for Pakistan.
What's your favorite chapter in the book?
I don't know. Fond of too many of them. Just how cricket started. The introduction, the story of Saba Nazir is something that has moved me. It's choked me to tears at times. Certainly when I was talking to her, I've overheard that. I mean, I've heard it again and again, twice or thrice. And every time it sort of, it brings me to tears, that story. Chapter 9... a lot of chapters. I don't have a single specific chapter, so to say.
And is there one person that you didn't get to speak to that you'd have loved to speak to for this book that you feel, and if you had spoken to them, you feel the book would have been more complete? Is there one particular person that you'd have loved?
Uruj Mumtaz. Okay. Uruj Mumtaz. I think she was the only massive, massive figure of Pakistan cricket that I didn't get to speak to. I mean, yes, Najam Sethi didn't speak. There was Wasim Khan, who didn't agree to speak. There was also Kanita Jaleel, who didn't speak. But Uruj Mumtaz, because she was... There's so many areas of conflict that she was a part of. I would have loved to get her version into the book, yeah.
And these people who refused to come forward, was it because of their own commitments, or was it just because of a fear, or just not didn't want to get involved?
I have no idea, because she had agreed to speak to me. We even had the initial conversation. I even sent her the plan. After that, also through a lot of people, I tried to reach out to Uruj. She told them as well that she'll speak to me But I don't know what the reason was. Was she busy with her life or she didn't want to speak? But this discussion went on for over 3 years between me and Uruj. Would you speak? But that never happened.
Did you manage to speak to Marina Iqbal?
Sorry?
Did you manage to speak to Marina Iqbal during the book? Marina Iqbal.
Marina Iqbal, yeah. Marina has spoken to her quite a few times,
Okay. Because she's another one of those commentators on the circuit.
Yeah.
Isn't she? Yeah. Currently calling the Under-19 World Cup. Final that your country is participating in tomorrow.
Yeah. And semi-finals.
Yeah, I mean, they've won the semi-final, haven't they? Yesterday, they defeated New Zealand. So now they're through to that.
They beat New Zealand. They'll be in the final. Yeah. England and India,
So I'm just wondering, whenever India win their first ever title in women's cricket, how much can that inspire Pakistan, as a neighbour, as a fellow Asian country?
So from whatever I've gathered, speaking to the women of Pakistan, this is beyond the cricket field, is that it's not just about cricket, but various aspects of their socio-cultural lives. It's easier when India accepts certain things. When Indian women are able to do certain things, and it's not just the Indians, it's the Nepalese, it's the Sri Lankans, it's the Iranians, and people around Pakistan who are able to do certain things which are considered taboo for women in Pakistan. When there's acceptance by the neighboring countries, slowly the acceptance sort of comes to Pakistan as well. For a lot of things, I mean, something as simple as what kind of clothes you're wearing, sense of fashion, a lot of other things, which would otherwise not be acceptable. So I would believe that, yes, that would have an impact on Pakistan as well. The fact that, because India is growing at a phenomenal rate. Over the last 8 years, Indian cricket has immensely grown. I mean, today we are at a point where we are expected to beat England, where Indians are running Australia close time and again, beating them the odd time, and no other team is doing that. So to have reached that level from a point where even England seemed so far away, I think that should have an impact on Pakistan cricket as well.
Just coming back to, this is the penultimate question, but 2005, when the merger happened, and Shaiza and Kiran in particular didn't continue, how much did that hinder Pakistan's development? Because they sort of had to start again, didn't they, as a team? They had to start from scratch again with so many debutants, and their two leading players didn't play again at a time where they were really starting to come to terms with international cricket. So how much did that set them back in their sort of trajectory?
I mean, if you're looking at Pakistan now, you'll have to look at it as a team that started out in 2005, not in 97. Because whatever happened pre-2005, it has no bearing on with the team that was ready in 2005. Sorry. The team that was in 97 has no bearing on the team that was in 2005. So it's a team that has started out in 2005 in realistic terms. So yeah, they've started afresh, and you'd have to then see that Sri Lanka started out much earlier. In fact, Sri Lanka also started out in 96, 97. But to sort of understand, they had a local circuit in place for nearly a decade by then. So they were playing, even though they were not playing international cricket, they were playing competitive cricket, which wasn't the case for Pakistan. I mean, Pakistan, yes, you can say cricket started out in the 1970s and 80s. But because there was no continuity to it, the team that came in 97 had no bearing on all the structural cricket that was going on in the 70s and 80s. So yes, they've started out multiple times over Pakistan cricket.
Just one more question that I wanted to get in that has just come to my mind. I don't think you managed to speak to Sajda Shah, did you? Who took 7 wickets for 4 runs or something like that when she was 15?
Sajda Shah. Yeah, I didn't speak to Sajda Shah either.
She also made her debut when she was 12, didn't she? Or apparently 12. So that was a shame. I mean, that.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's another name you would have loved to speak to. She's
the
record holder, both with that age and those sort of bowling figures. So coming back to yourself, is this the first book you've written?
And technically my second book, the first book I wrote as a teenager, it was a teen fiction. but it was ready to get published. I lost the book, so yeah. But first published book, yes.
And has this inspired you to write more in the future?
Yeah, because you're constantly coming up with ideas, because the findings of one book, sort of, when you're looking to find research on one book, there are other materials that are coming through which might be useful for other books or other stories. So ideas are constantly popping up, but I don't know if I have the energy and the time to sit and write another book. Back then, it was much easier during the pandemic. There was not a lot of work, not a lot of cricket that was going on. So I had a lot of time to myself.
And having written this book, has Pakistan sort of become your second team in women's cricket, at least?
Sorry? No, I've been writing on... So even before I wrote on Pakistan cricket, I had written on Indian... I've been writing on Indian cricket for a real long time. I have written on South African cricketers, on Australian cricketers, English cricketers, West Indians, New Zealanders. So I have written on women's cricket for a long time now.
No, but
my first interview happened like in 2012. Yeah. So it's been now 11 years.
No, but in terms of extensive work and putting a whole book together, I'm sure that makes that's a factor, isn't it? For perhaps putting Pakistan as your second team going forward, in women's cricket at least.
Sorry.
I mean, you've put this book together. Is Pakistan now your second team in women's cricket, having, you know, compiled this book and put so much effort into getting all this together and having, you know, researched into their story?
Yeah, I mean, there is a soft corner for the team because you sort of know them at those barriers where, you know, you're not looking at them as just as cricketers. You know some things about their lives, of them as people, as person. And they're such wonderful, wonderful people. So genuine, so grounded. You don't find that in athletes, honestly. Most of the athletes you sort of come across, the kind of simplicity that they have about their lives and their thoughts and all of that. So yes, of course, there is a massive soft corner for them. And that wish to see them do well and achieve their dreams and be happy and be proud of whatever they're achieving. That it's sort of conflicted. Even when they're playing against India, you sort of, it's a conflicted heart and mind. You don't know which team are you supporting, really. So that tends to happen at times.
Okay, so we'll leave it there. Thank you very much again for your time, Ayush. And I've purchased the book and I look forward to getting stuck into it. I've looked at the photos so far and read bits and pieces, but look forward to getting stuck into it properly. I've already read some of the articles that have been published online that you've shared, but look forward to, you know, getting through it properly, step by step. Yeah. So thank you for answering those questions, and it was good to talk, and thank you very much again for your time. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Abdullah. Lovely talking to you. I'm so sorry this took a lot of time. A lot of tech issues I had to face, but I had a great time talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.